We're holding Pei Amud Aleph, the Mishnah. Now that we learned in the previous Mishnah that if a person sold a beehive, then automatically, even if not otherwise specified, he sells the bees with it. So now, in a similar vein, then the Mishnah is going to talk about. We're going to digress a little bit from the topic that we've been talking about of when you sell item A, is item B included within it or not? So now the mission is going to focus on where somebody is selling the future products of a beehive or other such things, or a birdhouse, or the other kinds of things that we were mentioning before. Now, of course, you can't sell a davar shelo bala olam. You can't sell something that doesn't exist yet. Only according to the mayor, we said you could, but here we're talking about, let's say, for example, we're going to talk about a birdhouse, and he's selling the future birds that are going to be born there. Not so much that he's selling the future birds as that he's selling the birdhouse in so far as the birds that are going to be born there.
He's selling subject to a birth.
No, he's selling the future birds that are going to be born there. So first of all, there are Rishonim who learn, actually, the Meiri, the Mukhi Yosef, say that, yes, you can't sell a davar shelo bala olam, but all that means is that you have the right to back out of it. If you don't, then the sale still remains. So the Mishnah would be talking about that, straightforward. He says, for example, I'm going to sell you the future birds that are going to be born in this birdhouse during the next year, subject to the conditions that it's going to say in the Mishnah, and then fine, we would say it is a davar shelo bala olam, but fine, if he doesn't back out of the deal, then the deal still stands. On the other hand, the Rambam explains that what we're talking about is he's saying, I'm selling you the birdhouse in so far as the birds that are going to be born in it. Meaning, in other words, the same way as, for example, I could sell you a tree, not so much where you own the tree, but where I'm selling you the future, the tree in so far as the fruits. You will have the right to collect the fruit when it grows, and that's not davar shelo bala olam, because the tree right now exists. So the same way we could say over here, and there's fruit.
So one second. So one says you sell the birds, and the other one says you sell the birdhouse, a conditional bird.
According to the Rambam's Shita, yeah, you have to structure the deal. You have to say that you're selling the birdhouse for the birds, as regards the birds. In other words, I could sell you the birdhouse outright, or I could sell you the birdhouse that your ownership of it is limited to, that the birds that are born in it will be yours. So that's not a davar shelo bala olam.
But the bird is not a birdhouse. The birdhouse is a birdhouse. It's not a bird.
No. If you say, I'm selling you the birdhouse, and the sale is limited to that you will have the right to the birds that will be born in this birdhouse, then that's the equivalent of saying, I'm selling you this tree. You don't own the actual tree. You can't harvest it for wood or whatever, but you will be entitled to the fruit that grows from it. That's how it's called. It's called Dekel Leperoisav and other such examples, and that works. So according to the Rambam, that's the case we're talking about over here, whereas according to the Nimuka Yosef and others, we're talking about that it could be straight out that he says, I'm selling you the birds, and it is a davar shelo bala olam, but fine. All it means is he has the right to change his mind later, but if he doesn't, then we still have to discuss the sale is a sale, and then we have to discuss that some birds have to be left behind, which is going to be the thrust of what our Mishnah is talking about.
We're talking about two different things here. Either sell a birdhouse.
We're talking about the Mishnah says, Halakeach Peres Shrevach Mechaber. The question is, what does that mean? That he's going to be buying the produce of that birdhouse from his friend. Does it mean that he's buying in advance the actual produce, the actual birds themselves? And then how does that not run afoul of the principle of Einon Amakne Davar Shelo Bala Olam? And the answer would be, sure, it's a Davar Shelo Bala Olam. But if he wants to go through with the deal and he plans to do that, he will give the other guy the right to take those birds as they are born during the year, then still the other guy has to leave him X number of birds, as we're going to discuss now in the Mishnah and the Gemara, in order that the birdhouse is not completely abandoned, because that's the thrust of the Mishnah, not so much whether he's entitled to the birds, of course he is, but what he has to leave behind. According to the Rambam, that still wouldn't work, because the Rambam learns that you can't sell davar shelo bala olam, even in the sense that it's not a binding sale at all. and therefore later on, it's not just a question like the Nemuka Yosef says, could he change his mind? It's more, do we even have a sale here? And the answer is that no. But if he said, I'm selling you the birdhouse with the sale being limited to the product, the future products of that birdhouse, then that works in the same way as you could do that with a tree.
Let's
learn the Mishnah. Let's learn the Mishnah. That's the point. You have those different opinions. There are other opinions of Rishonim that discuss the whole subject. It is a bit of a complicated subject, and there are a lot of opinions of Rishonim and Achronim that are relevant to it. But right now, we're going to focus on what the Mishnah is talking about. Given that the birds are sold, however we understand it, however we understand the halachic theory behind it, we have the practicalities that you have to leave them behind X number of birds, which is what the Mishnah is going to focus on. So, halakeach
peiros shoy. You sell the birds to
Ham. Right now, I explained.
But we haven't moved forward yet.
We see a couple of the opinions of the halachic theory behind how it's going to work. Right now, we want to focus. The Mishnah is going to focus for us not so much on that halachic theory, but on the practicalities of given that, however we understand it on the theoretical level, we have a sale. Now we have to figure out how many birds have to be left behind so that the birdhouse is not left completely empty. So let's focus on that. Afterwards, if you want, we can go in when we're done with the daf, we can get back to the halachic theory behind it and discuss the opinions and discuss the different opinions. So the Mishnah says, "Halakeach peiros shoyvach mechaber." A person buys the products of the birdhouse, of the dovecot, from his friend. So basically, in other words, the Rashbam says he tells him. Now, the way it works is the birds lay eggs there, which eventually hatch and become chicks, approximately every month. In general, every month, except the Rashbam says, except in Adar. So let's say in Nissan, he says, sell me whatever is going to be born throughout this year. Again, he would have to say, sell me your birdhouse insofar as the birds that are going to be born in it, according to the Rambam, or sell me the actual birds themselves, and as long as neither of us backs out of the deal, then it will be binding, but whatever. The point is that he hasn't bought the mothers themselves because he said that I'm buying the payrus, the future products. So now it's not just enough to leave behind the mothers, because as the Gemara is going to establish over here, as the Rashbam is going to explain, and as the Gemara is going to clarify, if you just take all of the eggs or all of the chicks, the mothers are not going to want to stay behind either. They're just going to go and find themselves someplace else to nest, and then the entire birdhouse is going to be empty, and that defeats the purpose of the sale. So, mafriach bricha rishona, so he has to allow to fly, he has to allow to remain in the birdhouse and able to fly around it, the first pair of birds. Bricha means a brood, means the Rashbam describes, every month approximately, the doves lay two eggs, and generally one's a male and one's a female. And then 2 months later, the young ones that were born are themselves ready to produce children and so forth. So what you would have is, let's say, in Nissan, let's say they lay a clutch of eggs, two eggs, and then by Sivan time, that second generation themselves are producing the third generation and so forth. So now the Mishnah is saying you have to leave Bricha Rishona, which on the face of it means you just have to leave the ones that were born in Nissan. And then after that, you're allowed to take them. But we're going to see in the Gemara that it's not. We're going to see in the Gemara that's not so simple. Anyway, continues the Mishnah. Peiros kaveras. Similarly, if he's buying the future products of a beehive, and that means again the bees that are going to be born during the coming year or during whatever the coming amount of time. So again, if you take all the bees, the problem is then there's nothing left in the beehive, and that defeats the whole purpose, because he wants a beehive with bees in it who are going to produce honey for him. So in a similar vein, Notel Gimel Mechilim, he can take, the Rashbam describes the biological facts behind it, which is, you have swarms of bees, you have a bunch of bees are born. He describes at the beginning of the summer, you'll have a swarm of bees will come out of the hive and go and start a new, and then go to and go find a branch to nest on temporarily, and then you'll bring a beehive and you'll colonize, and you'll, and they will colonize that beehive. Another 9 or 10 days later, the next swarm will go out and so forth. The point is, in other words, as the population of the beehive increases, more of them swarm out and they find them, and they get themselves a queen bee, basically, and they, because the queen bee is the one that lays the eggs, and they go and found the new colony. And so you're providing an empty container, an empty beehive for them to go and colonize. The Rashbam describes, he says, interestingly, that in Malchus Yavon, which is the Byzantine Empire of his time, so the areas of Greece and Turkey and Bulgaria and what have you, they would do sometimes even 7 or 8 times throughout the season. In this, he says here in France, they do it only 3 times. Each subsequent swarm of bees is weaker than the previous ones. So the ones that are born earlier in the season are the stronger and the bees, and the ones that are better going to produce honey and produce the next generation of bees, and the second one less so, and the third one less so, and so forth. Anyway, the point is that, again, you can't, so you can't take all the bees, because then the bees will be completely empty. Noto gimel mechilim, therefore the buyer can take the first 3 swarms that come out of the hive. Those will be the best quality bees, and therefore the honey that they produce will be the best quality. Or misaris, and then he's misaris. Now we're going to see in the Gemara 2 meanings of misaris, what happens thereafter. Another case, chalos dvash. Suppose that he's buying the actual honeycomb. So the previous case was he's buying the bee, and the bees eventually will produce the honey. Now we're talking about that he wants to buy the actual honeycombs themselves, when they're produced. So here he hasn't sold the hive at all, but he's buying the honey. Maniach beis chalos, he has to leave 2 honeycombs, because that's what the bees are going to live off of during the winter. They're not flying around collecting nectar from flowers. Therefore, you need to leave them a certain amount of honey. They themselves collect the honey as far as they're concerned. They collect the honey for themselves to eat. The fact that we human beings get a benefit from their honey and their wax, they're not consciously doing it for that, of course. So therefore, you can take most of the honey and most of the wax, but you have to leave some of it behind for them to live off of during the winter. Similarly, zaysim lokot. Similarly, a person buys olive trees with the understanding that he's gonna cut them down. So maniach shtei grifios, he has to leave behind 2 branches, and that way the tree can regrow from there. Because again, if he were to take all the branches, then he's leaving the guy basically with just an empty stump, and that's not what he bought. So in each case, in other words, the point is, in each of the cases of our Mishnah, given that there was a sale over here, the sale implicitly said that the original main object is going to continue to exist and is going to continue in its current state, and therefore we have to discuss how much has to be left over in order for it to maintain its current state and be able to continue to flourish and produce fruits in the future. So the Gemara starts off when it comes to the doves. V'hatanya bricha rishonu shniya. Now the Mishnah is telling us that you need to leave behind only the first brood of babies that are born. So let's say, for example, again, they're laying eggs in Nisan, and those eggs hatch, and then the following month the parent birds, the ones that you originally put in the birdhouse, or the ones that came and nested there themselves, rather, because that's how these birdhouses generally work. It sounds like the Mishnah was saying that you just have to leave behind the babies that were born in Nisan, the ones from Adar and the ones from Iyar and on and so forth. The buyer can take them and not worry about that the parent birds will fly away. The problem is, Braisa says bricha rishonu shniya, which on the face of it means that you have to leave behind the babies that were born in Nisan and in Iyar. So what is it? So the answer is Amar Kasha halacha le'ima. It depends whether you're talking about the baby bird or the mother bird. In other words, when the Braisa is saying shnia, it doesn't mean the second clutch of eggs that were laid by the mother bird. It means the second generation. Meaning, in other words, that you need to leave behind. So in our case, you would need to leave behind the eggs that were laid in Nisan, and the chicks that hatch from them. Then then also they themselves, by Sivan time, 2 months later, they're going to be mature and they're going to be laying eggs and they're going to be laying and fertilizing eggs of their own. So you have to leave also. So now in Sivan, they lay, that second generation lays their eggs and they hatch. And that third generation then, which is the first babies of the second generation, is also what you have to leave behind. The point is that way, with all of that, as the Gemara is going to explain now, the way that the birds think, basically, that causes it that the grandparents, the original pair of birds that nested there and produced the first eggs in Nissan, are going to want to stay there. And that way, in the future, those parents will continue to produce eggs in Tammuz and in Av and so forth. And meanwhile, the second generation that first reached maturity in Sivan are going to also, so you'll leave the ones that they laid in Sivan for them to be to keep them company, as Gemara is going to put it. And then the ones that they laid in Tammuz and Av and so forth, you'll be able to take and so forth. So that's what it means, Shnia. So the Gemara says, "Maishna ima demitzav sabrata va'azuga." So what's the difference when it comes to the mother? When it comes to the mother, you're telling me that she needs for company. It's not enough for her to have her. She has to have her daughter, and she has to have her mate. And you're saying without that, she's going to be motivated to say, what am I staying here for? I don't have all the eggs that I laid, all the chicks that I raised are all gone. So I might as well leave myself and find someplace else. So another birdhouse to nest in for the future. So you're saying that therefore she needs her daughter and her mate to stay there. Well, by the same token, Ihinami, so the daughter also, Titsavsa ima vazukad vazuga jishakinama. Look, we left her mate because she has her male that she mated with to produce those eggs. She has her mother as well. Shouldn't that be enough to keep her company, to make her in her little bird brain realize, you know what? Hey, this place is a good place to nest for myself and my family. Why do we need to leave the daughter's daughter? Why do we need to leave the daughter's children in order for her to realize I want to stay here? And the answer is, ima abrata mitzavsa. The difference is the mother finds it enough to have her children's company. And therefore, so if the children are there, then the mother is going to have, with her natural maternal instinct, is going to want to stay there. Brata ima lemitzavsa, but it's not the other way around. The daughter is not going to think, because my parents are living over here, because my mother is living over here, therefore this is a good place to stay. She's more likely to think, if I don't have my own babies over here, then I may as well strike out on my own someplace else. You know, like they say, for example, you know, children have more, human children as well. Human parents have a lot more rachmanus on their children than the other way around. The famous expression has it that one parent can support 10 children, but 10 children won't support one parent. So in the same way over here, talking as far as birds are concerned, as far as doves are concerned, the same way, when the mother has her babies nearby, that motivates her to think, this is a place that I should stay for the sake of my children. But the child herself is not going to think that way, that because my mother is here, therefore I should stay here for the sake of my mother, and therefore she's more likely to fly off. Therefore, you need to leave her first clutch of babies in order that now, I have children of my own over here, therefore I should stay here. And that way, the point is, the birdhouse remains with a minimum population of birds, and that way it doesn't just become completely empty, and that way eggs and chicks continue to be produced.
This guy who bought the nest, he has to keep a cheshbon which generation.
Yes, so he would have to keep a cheshbon of the generation, sure. Yeah. The Rambam, by the way, has a, first of all, this is according to the Rashbam. Tosfos actually explains a little bit differently that it means that first of all, Tosfos says it doesn't just mean the second one. It means that we're going to have to continue that way throughout the generations, each time leave the first one behind. The Tosfos is saying, in other words, that you have to leave. So Rashban is saying, all you have to do to continue our example, you leave behind the parent birds, the ones that originally came there. You leave behind the babies the babies from the eggs that they laid in Nissan, and then you leave the babies of those babies that were born in Sivan 2 months later when they're maturing. And then that's it, Rashban says. That's enough. So that's three generations there. According to Tosfos, you would have to leave every time that that the new generation starts. You would have to leave the first one of that one. The Mishnah only mentions the Mishnah only mentions Rishon. The Braisa stands on that and says Rishon or Shnia. Tosfos says it's not like the Braisa also means the same thing with third and the fourth and so forth generation. But the Braisa is not going to go and then continue giving us a list of numbers. But we're meant to understand that it's an ongoing thing. The Rambam has yet another explanation. The Rambam explains that what it means is the Rambam learns that it means from the first generation you have to leave the first clutch of babies. From the second generation you have to leave the first two. So
two
will keep them there. In other words, yeah. So regardless, according to all the various explanations, the Rambam, Tosfos, so the Rambam, the point is all the same. Given that you haven't bought the actual, if you bought the actual birdhouse itself, you could do whatever you want. You could take all the baby birds if you want, and if the mother birds fly away, big deal. Okay, eventually other birds will come and colonize the place. But here you only bought Peiros Shoybach. Whether according to the Rambam that you bought the Shoybach for its Peiros, or whether you're talking about according to the Nemuka Yosef that you bought the Peiros themselves, either way, the understanding is that you're going to leave something behind that there will continue to be Peiros, and that requires you to leave these clutches of babies in order for that to happen. Next, we said in the Mishnah Peiros Taveras that if you're buying the future products of a beehive, again meaning the bees that come from the beehive, we said Noito Gimel Nechilin Masaris. So we said you take the first three swarms, which is the Rashbam explained, the first few swarms that come out from that beehive are the stronger bees, the ones that are going to produce more baby bees in the future and more honey. By the way, you have to realize that when it comes to bees, most of the population of a beehive are females they're called worker bees. They're sterile. They don't produce the actual children. They just produce the honey. Then you have the queen bee, which is the one that produces the children for the next generation. And then you have the drones, the males that live for a short time, and their job is to fertilize the females, fertilize the queen bee.
And they don't work.
They don't work. They only live basically just in order to reproduce the species. Yeah. So again, you take the first three swarms. After that, you take those. That's enough. Now you have enough swarms of bees to start new colonies, and therefore that's what it means when you bought Peiros Taveras. It's understood that you bought three swarms because, as the Rashbam points out, also in his times in France, beekeepers would do the same thing. They wouldn't even bother with the swarms of bees after the first three because those are the bees born later in the season are going to be the weaker ones. So the Mishnah had said the expression umasaris. Now, on the surface, masaris is from Latin cirrus, which means to castrate. First of all, it's a little hard to castrate bees, but al pi halacha, it's questionable whether you'd be able to anyway. The Torah tells us you're not allowed to castrate animals, and there are nosekelim on Shulchan Aruch that discuss the same thing may apply to insects as well, not just behema chaya va'oif. But besides that, also given, practically speaking, most of the bees are sterile anyhow, there's nothing to sterilize them. So in what way are you sterile? In other words, when we say sterilizing, we're meant to understand that it means preventing them from having more children afterwards. So what does that mean? Omer of Yehuda, Omer Shmuel B'chardo, we give them mustard plants, and they eat the nectar and then possibly other parts of that. So what does that mean? How does that help? So they explain in the West, meaning in Eretz Yisrael, and in the name of Rabbi Yosef Reb Chanina, it's not that actually the eating mustard causes them to become sterile, but because the mustard, or the nectar from it or whatever is sharp tasting, therefore they eat their honey in order to counteract that. So in other words, what happens is that the Rashbam explains. So then they end up filling up on the honey. They end up filling up on the honey, and the result is they're not bothering to produce. They're not bothering to produce children anymore. Instead, they focus more on honey. In modern terms, I mean, you'd have to ask a beekeeper for the details. I was looking it up, and I couldn't quite follow the discussion because I've never done beekeeping. But the idea seems to be, again, we're not talking about the worker bees, whether they produce children or not, they anyway never do. But the point is that based on what hormonal signals and dance signals or whatever they do in the hive, the queens will produce more eggs or fewer eggs, and that's going to depend on what the worker bees are feeling in terms of the number of bees in the colony and the amount of food sources that they have available and so forth. So therefore, the idea is, in other words, what we're saying is, look, you're buying the teres kaveres. After all said and done, primarily you want the honey that they want. You're not so interested in the bees themselves. So what we're saying is, after the first three swarms, after that, you want to motivate the bees to produce more honey. And the way to do that is instead of that the queen should continue to lay eggs, because at that point you're not really interested in that anymore. Also, I think there's something along the lines of also the honeycombs within the hive itself. Some of them are filled up with eggs, others are filled up with honey. So you want fewer of them after the first little bit. You want fewer of them to be filled with eggs. That'll be the next generation of bees, and more with honey. So he's describing by doing that, by having them eat certain kinds of plants, such as mustard, then that causes them that now in the future, they're going to produce more honey, which is what you're after all. So therefore that would be the masarsam. So in other words, you would bring near the hive, you'd bring mustard plants and they would go to those for their nectar. So the point is, in other words, when we say mesarsan, so Rabbi Yosi Bar Chanina is saying it's not that literally it has a sterilizing effect on the bees, but rather that motivates them to produce more honey and fewer, and that there should be fewer babies, fewer eggs. Yeah. So that's one explanation. Rabbi Yechanan has a whole different explanation. The word mesaris doesn't mean to sterilize. It means he does take three swarms of bees, as we said, where you can use those to start new colonies of bees and new beehives, but it means that he's taking every other one. So the word mesaris means every other one. Like you have the word sirug in Moshen Kodesh, which means alternating. So the same way sirus, he's saying, means the same thing. So it means alternating. So in other words, you're taking the first swarm of bees, but you're leaving behind the second one for the owner, so that the population, the beehive, will remain stable. And you take the third and leave the fourth and so forth. You take every other one. That's how Rabbi Yechon explains the Mesaris of our mission. So Masnis Atana in a Braisa we learned, similar to Rabbi Yechon, Noto Gimon Chilin. Noto Gimel Nechilin Bezeh Achazeh, he can take a little bit different than Rabbi Yechon. He can take the first three successive ones, because as the Rashbam said, the first three are the best quality bees. They're the ones where when you establish new colonies, when you set up new beehives, they're going to go and energetically produce honey and a certain amount of eggs to keep the population for the next generation. Mikan Ve'elach, after that, like Rabbi Yechon says, Noto Achas, Maniach Achas, you take every other one. And again, the idea is that some of them are they're going to be gradually less and less good quality bees. But the point is, you're leaving some of them behind so that there'll be a colony in there, so there'll be a population there in the future. And again, the idea is, depending on the population of the hive itself, is how much the worker bees themselves are motivated to produce honey. So the point is, this way it balances out that you, the buyer, are able to get a decent supply of bees and a decent supply of honey, and still leave for the original owner that there will be bees in the hive and there will be honey in the hive in the future. Next, we said in the Mishnah, chalas dvash, that he's buying the honeycombs themselves, maniach shtei chalas v'chola, then we said he has to leave behind two honeycombs, because again, that's going to be the supply of honey that the bees are going to live off over the winter. During the winter, the bees are basically, they're not quite hibernating, but they're pretty close to it. So they basically stick around inside the hive, and they need something to eat, and then during that time, they live off the honey that they've stored up.
There's a lot of room there for all the bees.
Depending on the size of the population. I mean, the pastures also, so that's the thing also, you know, you have those male bees that I mentioned whose purpose is basically just to fertilize the queen. After that, once they're done with that, the worker bees kick them out of the hive. Basically, they either kill them or kick them out of the hive because they have no more purpose and they're just more mouths to feed. So during the winter time, all you're going to have in the hive then is going to be, if it's going to be female, it's going to be the queen. And a few workers, but they need something to live off of. So, you'd have to, again, you know, I guess if you'd want to understand this Gemara in more detail, you'd have to talk to a beekeeper and find out how they actually work things. But yeah. Okay. Anyway, we said so now let's talk about those stay phallus. Let's talk about the honey in the hive. Omer of Kahana, Dvash Bekaveras. So Rav Kahana says that the honey that's in the honeycombs, in the hives, Eina Yotze Mide Maicha La'olam, it never loses the status of food as far as the halachas of tum of attack. So in other words, it's always considered human food, even though the Rashbam says if you specifically designate it that it's going to be food for the bees for the coming season, then we would say that not. But otherwise, we're saying by default we would assume that all the honey in the hive is going to be collected for human food, and therefore it retains that status. Tosfos actually questions that, because in any case the halacha is that according to the Rashbam, that if you were to say about a particular honeycomb, you know what, I'm leaving this one behind for the bees, then it wouldn't be makabel truma anymore. How could that be? Once it's roi l'maichel adam, once something is suitable for human food, it doesn't lose that status unless it becomes ein roi l'achilas kel. So Tosfos leaves that question open.
It is good for Michael Adam, but it's also their food.
Right, so that's the thing. The Rashbam gives two explanations. One is that even though sometimes the bees eat it, nevertheless, it's still considered human food unless you set it aside specifically for them. Or the Rashbam gives a second explanation. What Rav Kahana means is as long as it's in the honeycombs, it's considered food. When it flows out of them, what you do is you heat up the honeycombs so the wax starts melting and the honey can flow out freely. Then at that point, it becomes not a mice. Then it becomes a mashke. It becomes one of the shiva mashke. So that's the Rashbam's second explanation of what it means. So the Gemara says alma kasavar. So we see that Rav Kahana holds loy boy machshava. It doesn't require for it to be considered human food, and for it to be makabel tuma, it doesn't specifically require that he has in mind that it's going to be for human food. By default, it's considered human food. And therefore it's makabel. So again, according to the Rashbam's first explanation, it's makabel tumah b'chlal. And according to the second explanation, we're saying that as long as it's in the honeycombs, it's food. And once it's made to flow out of there, then it becomes a liquid in halacha, which means that it's machshel makabel tumah, and that it has the dinim of tumas mashkim and so forth. So the question is, basically, there I have a contradiction on Rav Kahana. A brisa says dvash bekaveres, where the honey that's in the honeycombs, ain't a loy oichel v'loy mashke, it's not considered food or drink. It's not considered a liquid as far as being mash or the kabel truma, and as far as the different dinim of trumas mashkin, and it's not considered food. Rav Kahana is saying that it is. The answer is Amar Abaye v'nitzchah v'loy sin shtei chalos. Abaye says the brisa is talking about those two chalos that we said that you leave behind, the two honeycombs that you leave behind in the hive for the bees to eat. So therefore, that's specifically reserved for them. And a person is Masiyah Das from that. A person is not going to bother taking that, because the whole point is he needs a food supply for the bees over the winter. So those don't become food in the first place. That's one way of explaining it. Rav Amar, Rav says a different answer. The Braisa, Rav Yezir. The Braisa may even be talking about all the honeycombs, not just the two, but the Braisa would be according to Rav Yezir. The Tanan, namely, we learn in a Mishnah among other things, in Masechta Uktzin, it's one of the last Mishnayos in Shas. Anyway, Kaveres Dvorim, you have exactly that of a hive. We learned this before as well. We learned this a couple of weeks ago. Rabbi Eliezer says that it's considered like the ground, even if it's not attached to the ground, as we explained over there, that Rabbi Eliezer, actually the Gemara is going to bring again now, that on the face of it, the reason is because it generally stays in place. Soon the Gemara is going to explain that there's a different reason why Rabbi Eliezer considers it like the ground. So Rabbi Eliezer considers that it's considered like the ground in the sense that you can acquire a kesef shtar of chazaka, unlike metapolin. The coast for another prusbol, you can write a prusbol based on it, because as we said there, the loiva has to own karka, and he considers the beehive to be considered karka for that purpose. The coast for another prusbol, the enema kabel's tumor b'mekoima, it won't be able to be makabel tumor in its place. If you move it, then it's metalplin. But as long as it's kept in place, then it's not makabel truma because it would be like the ground. And Rabbi Yehuda said, if you take the honey out of it on Shabbos, then the person would be chayiv katas because it's considered like the ground. So therefore, taking the honey out of it, it's considered like as if like harvested the equivalent of harvesting produce from the ground. That's Rabbi Yehuda. V'chum v'aymim. Ain't kosher from allow prusbo. The Chum say you can't write a prusbo on the basis that the loiva owns a beehive because even if it's attached to the ground. So we discussed. We learned back on Daf Samach Vav. We talked about where if it's afterwards attached to the ground, does it change the din? But in other words, as long as it's movable, definitely. Then the Chachamim are saying it's not considered like karka at all. And even if it's attached afterwards, it's considered, it's called tolo shel vasot chibroi. It was separate from the ground. Now you've attached it to the ground. Does that change its status? Whatever. We discussed that over there. The point is that the Chum are saying that a beehive is not automatically considered like the ground, the way that Rabbi Eliezer is saying. So it will be makabel tuma even where it's sitting, even if you leave it where it's sitting. It's not like karka, it's not metalplin. To be koinet, you would need one of the methods to acquire metalplin, hagbar or kinyan chotzer or what have you. It becomes tumor, if it's makabel tumor, even if it's sitting in its place, because it's a keli. But a roid of a Shabbos potter, a person takes honey out of it on Shabbos, he'd be potter because it's not like detaching something from the ground, so it would be mutter d'oraisa, and only d'rabbonin as an ulcer. The point being that Rabbi Eliezer is saying that the beehive is considered like tarka. And Omer Rabbi Lozer, my time at Rabbi Eliezer, and Rabbi Lozer explained, the Amora explained, why does Rabbi Eliezer hold this? Dichtiv, because you have the story in Sefer Shmuel, where Yonasan takes some honey or Rashi says over there, it may have been a sugar, but whatever, that was flowing on the ground over there and takes a little bit of it with a stick. By Yitbal Oysa, by Yara Sadvash, it says he stuck his staff, his walking stick, into the Yara Sadvash, which literally means the forest of honey. On a pshat level, Rashi explains over there that means there was a stand of sugar cane over there, and there was sugar flowing out of them, and he took some of that. So it's called Yaras because there's a bunch of sugar cane growing over there. But here, nothing to do with bees. But here, the Gemara's understanding that it was bee honey, and why is it called Yaras, which means a forest? So Rabbi Eliezer learns from that. Between my Indian Yaras of Vash, why is the honey? What does honey have to do with a forest? So it tells you. Ma yara tolish men of a Shabbos chayv chatas, just like if a person were to detach a branch or a fruit or whatever from something in the forest on Shabbos, it'd be chayv chatas af dvash. The same thing with honey. Harodim menu Shabbos chayv chatas. Rabbi Eliezer is going to learn from that pasuk that if a person takes honey out of the beehive on Shabbos, he's chayv chatas. And from that he generalizes that more generally, therefore, so we see, in other words, it's considered like karka, and from that he generalizes all the other dinim that he mentioned. The point being, in other words, that Rabbi Eliezer is saying, therefore, that since it's like karka, then therefore the honey is not automatically going to be makabel tumah, just like the ground is not going to be makabel tumah, as long as it's in the hive, Rabbi Eliezer is going to say it's considered attached to the ground, therefore it's not makabel tumah. So when the Braisa had said that honey in the hive is not considered an oichel or a mashke, whereas Rabbi Kahana had said that it is considered a meifel, so the difference would be that Braisa is according to Rabbi Eliezer, and Rabbi Kahana is talking according to the Chacham. Okay. The Gemara says, Mesvi, though, I have another contradiction on Rabbi Kahana. So again, we do have to revisit what we learned previously when we had the sugya about the honeycomb over there. So first we were discussing the point when you have something that was detached from the ground and now is attached, is it makabel tumah or not? And we brought in this whole thing as far as the beehive. So we ended up saying over there, so first we thought that in general, Rabbi Eliezer would hold that, yes, it doesn't matter even if it was originally detached from the ground, as beehives usually are. He would say once it's attached to the ground, it's considered like the ground, and he would generalize from that to other dinim. Then we said over there that no, he holds specifically by beehives because on the basis of this fossil. So, uh,
Dipping in staff
into the that was on a weekday. They were fighting against the push.
Right. It shows that
it shows the fact that it calls it Yara Sedvash, Rabbi Yezu says, means that it's considered like a forest, and therefore it's considered like Kaka. Anyway, the point is that in our Gemara over here, in our Sylvia, we're giving two answers that how we reconcile this Braisa with Rakahana. Again, we had Abaya's answer, which is the Braisa, sure, the Braisa is points to Hachamim, but there's a difference between the two honeycombs that you're leaving behind for food for the bees over the winter versus all the other honey in the hive. Rava's answer was that the Braisa is points to Rabbi Yezer, Rakahana is talking the points of the Chacham. So now, the Gemara says, maybe then I have a contradiction on Rava's understanding of Rav Kahana versus the Braisa. A Braisa says, Dvash Azov Mikavarte, honey that flows out of the hive, Eina Loi Oichov Loi Mashke, if not considered food or it's not considered drink, as far as Tuma. So Bishleim La Abaya Nicha. So according to Abaya, it's very easy to understand how that Braisa fits with what Rav Kahana is saying, because the Braisa is talking about the shtei chalas, the two honeycombs that you're reserving for the bees, and Rav Kahana is talking about the rest. El l'rova, and so you're saying, even though it flowed out, which means, in other words, not available for the bees anymore, nevertheless, because it had been reserved for them, then therefore it's not makabel tova. El l'rova kasha, but according to Rava, that says that the whole reason is because it's according to Rabbi Eliezer, then it would be a kasha, because once the honey is flowing, even Rabbi Eliezer is not going to agree that it's considered like karka. So shouldn't we have to understand that it would mean that it's still that you have to think about it, that it's going to be food, and then it becomes food. The Rashbam brings over here that there was a different girsa that he had in front of him, that in Gemara is in front of him, that whoever wrote that girsa thought that we're dealing with the halachas of Shabbos over here, but no, we're dealing with the halachas of Tumah Batara. So as far as Mukta, he points out, as far as the dinim of Shabbos, never mind the question of whether you're allowed to take the honey out, and whether, as Rabbi Eliezer says, it would be an Isur Daraisa, according to the Chachamim, an Isur Darabanan, there's also the consideration of whether the honey itself that flows out on Shabbos is Mukta, because you didn't have intentions for it before Shabbos. But the Rashbam says, that's not what we're dealing with in our Sugya over here, we're dealing with Halachas of Tumah Batara. So according to Abaya, and then we're saying the Braisa is talking about the shtei chalas. You set them aside for the bees. So even though in this case it flowed out, something happened and the honeycombs softened and the honey started flowing out. Yeah. Whatever, it became hot outside. And nevertheless, it's still not considered food. But Rava is saying that the Braisa was referring before to all of the honey and all of the honeycombs in the hive. And he said it can work only according to Rabbi Eliezer. Well, once that honey flowed out, why should it not be considered food, or why shouldn't it be considered food or mashke? The answer is Amar of Zid. You're going to Zov Agabi Klimos. The case would be where it flowed out, but it flowed out on top of a dirty cave. So now we're going to still stick with, Rava is still going to say the Braisa was appointed over the Yezer. So now, yes, it's true that the Yezer would have to agree that once the honey comes out, it becomes an Oichel or a Mashke, but you do need Machshava. You do, because before it was considered like Karka. Now, in order for it to lose the status of Karka, it's not enough just that it flowed from the hive. You would also need to think. I plan to use this honey that flowed out for food, as food or as a liquid. But now it flowed onto a dirty keli. You're not going to want to do that. Therefore, you never had that machshava. Therefore, it doesn't reach the stage of being makabel tum. As opposed to, according to the Chachamim, it doesn't matter. Because even inside the hive, the Chachamim are holding, it's not considered like karka, and therefore you don't need machshava. Rav Acha by Yaakov Amar, Gven Shazov Agabe Kaskas. Rav Acha by Yaakov says, a bit of a different answer, that it doesn't have to be a dirty keli, but it flowed, for example, on splinters or chips of wood. So if it was, because he says, if it was on a dirty keli, okay, so the layer of honey that touched the dirt, you're not going to want, but you'll scrape off the rest from the top. But if it flowed onto kaskasin, practically speaking, you're not really going to be able to filter out all of that, all of the leaves and pieces of and chips of wood and whatnot from the honey, and therefore you're going to just be, you're not going to bother with it, and therefore that would be what the braisa means, that's not oichel or mashke. Well, okay, the Gemara says, Here's another relevant braisa, which is going to be, which again fits better according to Abaya's explanation, but not according to Rava's. A braisa says dvash bekavarta in a loy oichol b'lay mashka. Again, as long as the honey is in the hive, it's not considered a food or drink. Chishiv olav lachila. But if you thought about it and decided that you plan to eat it, metamet tumas oichlin, then it becomes, then it's able to have the tumah of food, meaning as far as the various dinim of that, in terms of, for example, that there needs to be at least a kibetza of it. By the way, the machlokas we're showing him on the question, is there a minimum amount of food that's makabel tumah? Do you need, everybody agrees that for food to transmit tumah to other food, you need a kibetza. It's machlokas Rashi and the Rambam, whether you need a kibetza for it to become tumah in the first place, or whether even a smaller amount can become tumah. Whatever, the point is that the honey, once you decided you plan to use it for food, has those dinim, as far as that, and as far as the various other dinim of Tumas Eichlin, Lamashkin, and if you thought about it, that you plan to drink it, to use it as a liquid, Metama Tumas Mashkin, and it has the dinim of Tumas Mashkin, as far as that a revius of it, rather than a kabetza, and as far as that Midrabanon, in general, it's considered a Rishon Latuma. When it becomes Tomei and Viria, and that can be Machshir, other food to be Makabal Tumah, and so forth, all the Jinim that apply to Machshir.
Or Revius or a Kabetza?
A Revius is more than a Kabetza. In modern terms, Rav Avraham Chaim Noah puts it that a Kabetza is around 2 ounces, and a Revius is around 3 ounces. The different poskim, the Chazanish, and the others who argue about the Shurim, they're going to have different numbers, but it's the same proportion, approximately. Yeah. But other than that, matzah mashkin, you need a larger amount, you need a revius. But other than that, the dinim of tumas mashkin generally are more stringent than tumas oichlin. First of all, food won't be makabel tumah unless it becomes wet with one of the shiva mashkin. But also that mashkin themselves, again, the rabbanon in general, when a liquid becomes tumay, it's going to always be a rishon latumah, even if what made it tumay was a lower degree of tumah. So you have, for example, Mishnayos described that you have a tevul yoin, who himself is considered a shady of truma. He touches a liquid of truma, for example. He doesn't make it a shlishi, as you would expect. He makes it a rishon. It's a data that I've done on the Gemara elsewhere, explains why the Chacham did that. Alpi Kabbalah, Rabbi Levi Yitzchak, Rebbe's father, explains that eating is related more to tzadah chesed and drinking more to tzadah gvura, and he explained it's actually based on a Zohar. And therefore, mashkim are more susceptible to truma, which comes ultimately from gvura. Drinking is more related to gvura. He said, basically, as Zohar explains, and Reb Levick explains that because of that, drinks are more susceptible to tumah. So the point is, so the Braisa had said that inside the hive, it's not considered food or drink. If you decide you're going to use it for food, then it now has the status of food, because all you need is machshava for that purpose. And the same thing, if you thought that it's going to be a liquid, then it's a liquid. Again, the Shleimala Abayim Nicha. So according to Abayim, there's no problem. That fits still with what Rav Kahana says. Because again, the Braisa is talking about the Shtei Chalas. The rest of the honey in the hive, yes, is going to be considered Maichel or Mashka, as the case may be. Rav Kahana had said that that's considered a Maichel. And only when it comes to the two honeycombs that you're reserving for the bees, then we would say you need a special Machshava for those. El Rava Kasha, but according to Rava, how would Rav Kahana's statement fit with the Braisa? Now we can't say anymore that the Braisa has pointed to Rav Eliezer, because Rav Eliezer's point was that the beehive is considered like karka. But here we're not talking about where it flowed out of there. Here we're talking about where the honey is still in the honeycomb, and all you did was think about it. So according to Rabbi Eliezer, that shouldn't be reason enough for that honey to be makabel tumah if he considers that the beehive is like the ground. Necessarily, this last braisa would be according to the Chachamim. Well then, how is Rava going to understand how that fits with what Kahana is saying, that it's considered automatically a maifel without that machshava? The answer is Amalach Rava. The answer is Rava can tell you tritz hachi. You have to correct the wording of the braisa and explain it as follows. That he would say, the Braisa is not saying that it is Makabel Tumas Oichlin or Tumas Mashkin, as the case may be, but rather, on the contrary, the Braisa is telling us that even though you thought about it, it still doesn't become Tumas Oichlin or Mashkin, because the Braisa, again, would be appointed a Eliezer, who says that as long as it's in the hive, it's considered Mechuba L'Karka, and it's not Makabel Tumah, and therefore that would be the Braisa is telling you should know the result of Rabbi Eliezer's opinion that a beehive is like Karka, is that even the honey that's in there, even though on the face of it, you could always take it out and eat it, But as long as it remains in there, even though you thought, I'm going to take it out and eat it, it still doesn't get Tumas Ochlin Umashkin. Which actually Tosfos says, it's not that really, I mean, how do you correct a Braisa to say the exact opposite of what it was saying? It says it is Mekabel, Tumas Ochlin or Tumas Mashkin. So how is Rava flipping that around? So Tosfos says he's not really. What he's saying is, when it's still in the hive, then it's not considered Michael or Mashka insofar as this. It's not considered a Michael insofar as that if you were to think about it, it would be Makabel Tumas Ochlin, but rather it's not. In other words, Rava is learning the words of the Braisa, Dvash Bekavarte, Eina Ochel Vloy Mashka, it's not a food or a drink, Rishavol of Lachila. And we're saying, even if you thought about it to eat, you shouldn't think that the Tama Tumas Ochlin, you wouldn't think, well, the Machshava should make it have Tumas Ochlin. And the Braisa is implicitly saying, no, nevertheless, it's still not Makabel Tumas Ochlin. So therefore, he's not really correcting the words of the Braisa, but he's reinterpreting it, that it would go according to the Braisa. Okay. So the Gemara says, Tanya Kavasei de Rav Kahana. Now we learn a Braisa that supports what Rav Kahana said in the first place. Dvash b'kavarta mekama tumas oichlin shaloi b'machshava. The honey, even when it's in the hive, is makabel food tumah, even if you didn't think about it, because automatically by default in the hive it's already considered food, even if you didn't make any specific plans to harvest it, except for the shtei chalas, we said, because those are reserved for the bees, so ordinarily you don't plan to eat it, and therefore that has a different din.
So
we'd say that those two are not makabel tumah unless you specifically had in mind. Okay. Next, we said in the Mishnah, zeisim lokutz, if you bought olive trees where the understanding is that you're going to chop off the branches. So again, in other words, you didn't buy the olive tree as a whole. If you did, you can do whatever you want with it. What we're talking about is you bought specifically insofar as that you're going to be able to chop off the branches. So we said you can't chop off all the branches because then you're just going to leave the guy with a bare stump. Instead, you have to leave behind maniach shtei groifias. He has to leave behind two branches, and that way the tree will continue to produce fruit and to regrow from there. So the Gemara continues. Tanan rabbanan halakeach ilan mechaber lokutz. A person buys a tree from somebody else where the deal is that he's going to be able to chop off branches from it, or you could even have lokutz with some of these kinds of trees will mean that he is allowed to chop down the whole thing, but in other words, yeah, how much does he have to leave behind so that it will regrow? So magbiyam in a karka tefach b'koitzitz. So he has to leave a stump in the ground of at least one tefach tall, because then the tree will regrow from that. The sulas hashikma and pashtus on that stump. We're not just talking about a bare stump. It's not going to grow from that. The pashtus, we mean there are some branches down during in that bottom tefach and leaves, and the tree can regenerate from that, depending on the kind of tree. The sulas hashikma, on the other hand, if it's a virgin shikma, now we learned in the previous parak, you have your shikma tree, which we said usually what you do is over the years, you chop off the branches and the trunk becomes thicker and thicker, and then you can use it for building beams. So in the case of a shikma, which has never had the branches cut off, then you have to leave shlosh tefachim, and you have to leave at least three tefachim of the stump, because with a shikma, these are practical matters that people who grow trees for a living would tell you these things. So you need at least three tefachim in order for the tree to eventually regenerate. So like this, you're chopping down the rest of it, and you're going to use the wood for beams or firewood or what have you. But you have to leave behind enough. Again, you didn't buy the tree as a whole. You only bought it lockwards. So therefore, you have to leave enough that it will regenerate and continue eventually to produce branches and leaves. Sadan shikma. If you're buying a shikma that has already had the branches previously chopped off and now the trunk has gotten much thicker. So then shnei tefachim, that's enough to leave two tefachim and the tree will regenerate from that. But kanim or bakfanim, when it comes to if you're buying reeds or if you're buying reeds like bamboo, for example, or if you're buying grapevines, then the way it's not a specific number of tefachim, min ha'pekach l'mayla. Then what you have to do is you have to leave over from above the pekach, which the pekach is the first knot, so the first joint. So like this, for example, you look at a piece of bamboo, for example. You have every so often you have a joint on it where then you have the bamboo itself is hollow, at least as we get it for snap or whatever. And in life, I think it has like some kind of fibrous material in there. But then you have every joint over there is where the leaves grow from. So then you have to leave. So you can cut off everything above that first joint, but you have to leave that one because then it's going to regenerate from that. And the same thing applies. The same thing applies to grapes. Tosfos actually points out that we learned in Bava Kamma that anyway that even without buying it, Yeshua made a tnai that you're allowed to cut off the ends of such things in order for you to have a branch that you can replant. Keep in mind with trees, you don't always have to plant a seed to grow produce. And in fact, with many types of trees, you don't want to because then it produces inferior fruit. What you do often is you take a branch from a tree and you plant it in the ground someplace else, and over time it develops roots, and then you have like a clone of the original plant. So if you bend it down into the ground and bury the end in the ground, and eventually it starts growing and eventually it separates from the parent tree, then that's called havrocha. You're not even doing that. You're cutting off a branch and you're going to plant it elsewhere. You'll water it whenever until it grows roots. So now we learned in Bava Kamma, we learned about the various tznoyim that Yeshua made when the Jewish people conquered Eretz Yisrael, and one of them divided up Eretz Yisrael, and one of them is that a person has the right to do that. He's allowed to take an end of a grapevine branch or bamboo branch or a bamboo, a bamboo reed or whatever, and take that and use that to produce a clone of it someplace else. So why do we need to talk about over here when you bought the grapevine or the bamboo or whatever, almanas that you're gonna chop it? So Tosfos says, listen, when it comes to Yeshua's takana, you can take it where you're gonna use it to establish a new grapevine or something. And the Gemara had mentioned over there various conditions. It has to be a new grapevine, it has to be a grapevine that's not yet producing fruit, and so on and so forth, as opposed to here, you bought it, then you have much more rights. You don't have those limitations. All you have the limitation is you have to leave enough that the grapevine is going to be able to continue to regenerate over the years. Continues the Braisa, b'dkolim u'va'arozim, when it comes to palm trees or when it comes to cedar trees, choifer u'masharish, then if you're buying it on the understanding that you're going to chop it, then you're allowed to dig down and remove even the roots. Lafisha and Gizan Machlif, because they don't regenerate anyway. If you chop down a palm tree, the stump is never going to regenerate new leaves or whatever. And the same thing with a cedar tree. So once you chop them down, there's nothing going to be left that's useful for the original owner anyway. So you may as well take the whole thing out of the ground, roots and all. The Gemara says, let's work out on some of the details that we're saying over here. Ovsulas hashikma shloisha tefachim behinan. You're telling me that for ovsulas hashikma, for a young shikma tree, you need three tefachim above ground for it to regenerate. Or a mini, I have a contradiction. We learn in Mishnayis Shviyas, which talks about the dinim of Shnita. It says, ein koitzin besulas hashikma b'shviyas. You're not allowed to chop off the branches of the shikma tree, the young shikma tree, during Shnita. Because that would be agricultural work that is also during Shnita. Because again, the point of cutting off those branches is to improve the growth of the trunk. And whenever you're doing something that's improving the growth of something, you can't do it on Shemitah. You can do things to prevent the plants from dying, but you can't do things to improve them during Shemitah. The Mishnah continues, Rabbi Yehuda and the Kedarke also. Rabbi Yehuda says it's true. If you were to do it in the normal way, then it would be Osir, where it helps the tree's growth. What you do is Elamak Bias, Sodat Fahim Bakotit. What you do is you chop off the branches either above 10 Tfahim, and once it's that high up, then it doesn't cause a benefit to the trunk. When you're chopping off the branches to make the trunk grow thicker, you're chopping off the lower branches, you know, the higher ones. Rabbi Yehuda is saying don't have that same effect on the tree. Or you cut it flush with the ground. So you're telling me that only if you cut it very close to the ground, me'ima oretz, right above the ground, then it's saying that it's harmful, and therefore Rabbi Yehuda is saying, fine, then in that case, you're not doing something to improve the tree. On the contrary, go ahead and do it during Shemitah. But it sounds like if you do it any place above ground, then it's going to be good for the tree. So what are we telling, what are we saying over here, that you need three full tefachim? It sounds like, based on what Rabbi Huda is saying, that even if you left only one tefach or two tefachim and chopped off the branches above that, it would help the tree. And yet here we're saying you need to leave three tefachim. The answer is, Amar Abaya, it's like the shlosha tefachim malima. When you leave at least three tefachim, as the Braisa and our Gemara had said, then malila, then it's good for the tree, and it causes it to, So the Rashbam, by the way, points out. Now the Gemara is asking based on Rabbi Huda's opinion. The Tanakama, you could say the Tanakama, you would say the reason why the Rabbi Huda had mentioned numbers. Rabbi Huda had mentioned 10 tefachim or close to the ground. The Tanakama, you could say the Tanakama holds some other figure. He might hold there's a difference between above three or below three tefachim. He didn't say one way or the other, but the Rabbi Huda, who's mentioning specifically 10 tefachim or flush with the ground. So where are we getting three? So where are three tefachim coming in? So the answer is, Amar Abaye, Gimel Tefachim Malila. What it is like this. When it's three tefachim, when you leave three tefachim, then that helps the tree. It causes that in the future, the tree will become thicker and be better suitable for building beams, like we said before. And if you do it flush with the ground, vade koshila, then there's no question it's going to be bad for the tree. And therefore, Rabbi Huda is saying, no problem doing that during Shemitah. Mikan ve'elach, but if it's in between the ground and three tefachim, loy mikshi koshila v'lavi v'yamalva. It's not really, it's neither here nor there, exactly. It doesn't damage the tree, but it doesn't do any good for it either. So therefore, gabi shvias, avdin and midi devade koshila. So when it comes to Shemitah, we have to act in a way that's definitely going to be bad for the tree, that's not going to help it in any possible way. Gabi mekuchomemku, avdin and madi vade midi devade malila. When it comes to buying and selling, you have to do it in a way where the seller, given that he didn't sell the tree as a whole, is definitely going to benefit, and therefore you have to leave at least three tefachim. Strictly speaking, actually, Tosfos says what it means is it's not that it has to be by shvius. You can only do something damaging. Again, you're allowed to do things to keep a tree alive, to maintain it. What it means is, in other words, not definitely one way or the other, as opposed to over here, since he sold the tree only for the purpose of cutting it, then you definitely have to leave him enough that the tree is going to continue to regenerate. So you, for example, you'll be allowed to, so to the extent you're allowed to water trees during Shemitah, for example, would be, again, with a kind that need to be irrigated and otherwise they're going to die, but not, for example, where you're doing it in order to improve the produce for the future. So there's many dinim along those lines, but that's the basic idea, in other words. So therefore, over there, Rabbi Huda is going to be machmer and say, you have to be careful to do something that's not going to definitely benefit the tree. You don't actually have to do something that'll kill it either. But, so therefore, he says either above 10 tefachim or flush with the ground over here. When we're talking about that, you want to make sure that the owner of the tree continues to have a tree for the future, then you have to leave him at least 3 tefachim.
That doesn't grow back.
Right, so flush, he's saying it's not going to grow back. And then we'll continue tomorrow. Best Hashem, the Gemara is going to continue analyzing the other part of the Braisa that we said as far as cedar trees, that we're saying that with cedar trees, once you chop them down, they're never going to regenerate. So you may as well take out the roots and all. We're going to discuss that in light of a drusha, a little piece of agadah that seems to say differently. So we'll learn that tomorrow. Best Hashem.
It's like a new Indian.
Not really a new Indian. It's a continuation of the Indian. But instead of talking about the shikma anymore, we're going to be focusing on the eres, on the cedar tree, and what is, in fact, what actually happens botanically with a cedar tree when you chop it down. Does it just never regenerate again, or does it? Okay.